coming up on Star Stuff. The Mars lander Curiosity to get some company with a new mission to study the red planet's interior. Rocket dust storms linked to high-altitude clouds in the Martian atmosphere. And thrust on as NASA's Dawn spacecraft departs the asteroid Vesta and aims for the dwarf planet Ceres on the next leg of its exploration of the asteroid belt. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
It seems NASA's Mars rover Curiosity is about to get some company. The American Space Agency selected a new mission to launch in March 2016 to take a first look deep into the Martian interior. The new mission, named InSight, will try to determine why Mars evolved so differently from the Earth, why it appears to lack plate tectonics and the geologic fault lines seen on Earth. Seismology is the standard method used by geologists to determine the Earth's internal structure, and InSight will open the door for the first similar investigations on Mars. The probe will take 6 months to fly to the red planet, then spend at least a full Martian year, 680 Earth days, on the surface gathering data. InSight was selected from a pool of three finalists in the NASA Discovery Series. The others included a robotic hopper that would sprint around the surface of a comet, measuring how sunlight changes the surface, and an amazing plan to set sail on the methane high seas of Saturn's moon Titan. NASA selected InSight because it incorporated proven mission systems, making it relatively low risk, most likely to come in on schedule and under the $425 million budgetary cap set for the project, not including the launch vehicle. The lander will carry four instruments. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, will provide an onboard geodetic instrument to determine the planet's rotational axis and a robotic arm and two cameras, which will be used to deploy and monitor instruments on the Martian surface. France's space agency will build a seismometer to measure Marsquake activity by measuring seismic waves traveling through the planet's interior. Unlike earlier missions to measure seismic activity, which placed the seismometer on the lander's legs leading to interference from wind, InSight will use its robotic arm to physically place the device on the ground. Finally, there'll be a German Aerospace Center-built subsurface temperature probe that will drill down 9 meters into the Martian crust, measuring heat flow from the interior of the red planet. InSight will also incorporate systems used on NASA's successful Phoenix lander, which was launched to the red planet in 2007 and determined that water existed near the surface in the Martian polar regions. The idea of early Mars as a warm and wet world where conditions were ripe for life have been dealt a bit of a blow, with a new study suggesting early Mars may actually have been a hostile and volatile volcanic world instead. A whole range of minerals detected on the surface of the red planet have in the past led scientists to speculate that they formed when water weathered surface rocks some 3.7 billion years ago. Liquid surface water means the planet must have been warmer and with a thicker atmosphere. But new research reported in Nature Geoscience claims the minerals, including iron and magnesium, may instead have been deposited by water-rich lava. The work's based on a study of clay minerals at the French nuclear testing site at Muaroa Atoll in French Polynesia. Scientists say the Muaroa clays, which do seem similar to the Martian clays, were actually formed from the precipitation of lava. They say that while water is needed to crystallize clays, that water doesn't have to be liquid, but could come from magmas instead. And because magmatic clays don't have climatic significance, they can't be used to prove one way or another that a planet was habitable or not during its early history. Previous studies of Mars have found evidence of past erosion by liquid water on the red planet, as well as clear signs of what look like river deltas, beaches and seashores, and what appears to be a long extinct ocean bed covering much of the Martian Northern Hemisphere lowlands. Only frozen water is known to exist on Mars today, although evidence of what could be recent flows of liquid water from subsurface aquifers have been found on several Martian cliff faces. Meanwhile, new research indicates that dust clouds floating kilometres above the Martian surface may be caused by high-speed air convection currents. The discovery helps explain the high dust content in the Red Planet's atmosphere and may also provide new insights into weather patterns on Earth. The research combined orbital observations from the European Space Agency's Mars Express probe with computer simulations. They found sunlight was being absorbed by dust particles and then re-radiated into the surrounding atmosphere, increasing temperatures by up to 20 degrees Celsius and causing the air to suddenly rise at speeds of 10 meters per second. This explosive convection, which the researchers are calling rocket dust storms, is capable of lifting dust particles to altitudes of up to 50 kilometers. That's different to Earth, where thunderstorms are generated by convection, with the heat coming from water vapor condensing into droplets. Scientists carrying out their Martian study were able to focus on an isolated individual dust storm, which allowed them to see more clearly what was happening than what would be possible in a more complicated environment such as Earth. The study, reported in the pre-press physics website archive.org and submitted to the Journal of Geophysical Research, found that these dust clouds were then transported horizontally by large-scale winds forming detached layers of dust. At night, the convection loop stops, but the dust particles are light and so they float down to the ground only very slowly. That results in a significant quantity of the suspended dust remaining in the air the next day when the convection loop starts up again. University of New South Wales planetary scientist Dr. Jonty Horner says the approach taken by the study could provide a better understanding of the global dust storms which cover Mars during its perihelion, the time when Mars is closest to the Sun. Previously, scientists used global modelling, which looks at the overall behaviour of the atmosphere on a planet-wide scale. That's good when you don't have lots of data, but it won't pick up localised weather events. The new mesoscale computer simulations, however, provide finer local resolution for areas of tens of kilometres through to a few hundred kilometres across. Horner says it's the first time he's seen modelling on this scale.
Mars is a very different planet to Earth, but it's one of the few objects in the solar system where we can get as much data as we can on it. Basically, the fact we've got so many landers on Mars, so many orbiters, means that we're getting a huge amount of very good quality data now on the precise details of Mars's atmosphere. Almost like we are for Earth, around Earth we've got huge numbers of satellites and we've got things on the surface that can measure the local conditions. And we've got the same thing on Mars, and we don't really have that for any other object in the solar system. And that makes Mars a really interesting object to study, to try and understand how its atmosphere works, how its climate works. Particularly given that in a lot of ways Mars is relatively similar to the Earth. It's a small planet compared to the giant planets Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. It's got a relatively thin atmosphere, whereas the other terrestrial planet with an atmosphere, Venus, the atmosphere is 100 times the density of the Earth, really heavy, really thick. Mars's atmosphere is about 1% of the Earth's atmosphere. But it's fairly similar in a lot of ways. It's clear a lot of the time. Sometimes you get clouds. And it's really interesting then to try and work out how the Martian atmosphere works. And one of the things that's particularly famous about Mars and particularly interesting are these global dust storms that are observed not quite every Martian summer, not quite every time Mars comes closest to the Sun, in fact, but quite often when Mars is at its closest approach to the Sun, these dust storms kick off and coat the entire planet in an atmosphere of dust so that you can almost not see any point on the surface. And that's never been fully understood before. And these guys are bringing in a new approach that, in the long term, may actually help explain just how that works. Previously, before these guys, people looked at the Martian climate and tried to use global climate modelling. Global climate modelling is the kind of thing that people are doing on Earth to try and model the effects of global warming, things like this, and it looks at the overall behaviour of the atmosphere on a planet-wide scale. And what those kind of climate models don't do particularly well is pick up the more localised things that we describe as weather. And there's a very clear distinction between the definition of weather and climate in all these kind of science, whether you're talking about the Earth or Mars. Climate is the global behaviour on very long timescales, and weather is what you'd experience on a day-to-day timescale. You know, so I can look out of the window today in Sydney, and it's wonderfully clear and sunny. There's a chance of a shower later on. That's weather. If we talk about the El Niño phenomenon that might make next summer quite hot and quite dry, then that's climate rather than weather. So the problem these global climate models have is that they just don't look at things with a tight enough resolution to pick up the local effects that we'd call the weather.
This is where this mesoscale computer simulation comes in?
Yeah, so what they're doing here is they're moving on and saying, well, what we think is important for these kind of dust storms, are effects that are simply on too local a scale for the climate models to pick up. They just don't resolve them. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at this dust storm that happened at a slightly unusual time of the year, which meant it was fairly well observed, but also happened on its own without being interfered with by other dust storms going on nearby. So it's a fairly clear-cut case of what's happening.
It's a good test case because of that. It's an isolated event.
Yeah, and we're going to apply a model that instead of trying to study the entire atmosphere of Mars, breaking down the entire atmosphere of Mars into cells, which is what these models do, where this entire dust storm will probably just fit into one cell, so it's hard to tell what's happening. We're going to look at what's called a mesoscale model, which is a medium-scale, more local model. So to give you an idea of the scales, a global climate model is looking at the climate across an entire planet.
Yeah.
A mesoscale study might be looking at tens of kilometres up to a few hundred kilometres. So it's the kind of modelling that maybe they'd use to look at the structure of a hurricane as it develops on Earth or something like this. Not quite narrow enough to look at an individual small cloud that you'd see a fair weather cumulus cloud, say, on a day-to-day basis,
yeah,
but rather to look at the weather on tens of kilometres scale. And that means you can look with much finer resolution at what's happening in within that phenomenon and model particularly the small-scale processes that on that local scale can have a really big impact. The really cool thing about this is it helps to answer a question that's been hanging around about why there are distinct layers of dust quite often in the Martian atmosphere, that it's these small localized dust storms that are triggering that kind of global canopy.
Is this the first time that they've managed to get something on this scale?
It's the first time I've seen modelling of something on this scale.
That's planetary scientist Dr. Jonty Horner from the University of New South Wales. Still on the red planet, NASA's Curiosity rover has begun its first major drive across the Martian surface. The $2.5 billion craft, which landed in Gale Crater just south of the Martian equator back on August the 6th, is driving to a spot about 400 metres east of its landing site called Glenelg. The location's interested scientists because it includes three different types of geography all in the one place. There's some ancient Martian bedrock to drill into, a bunch of impact craters to examine, and some surface geology identical to where Curiosity landed. The place was named Glenelg because it's in the opposite direction to Mount Sharp, the rover's ultimate destination. You see, Glenelg's a palindrome. It's spelt the same forwards and backwards, and Curiosity will need to backtrack in order to get to Mount Sharp. Over the past week, the six-wheeled car-sized rover's been fairly busy. It's undertaken its third drive of the mission, moving about 16 metres to examine an area scoured by the exhaust from its own sky crane engines used to lower it to the ground. It spent a day studying the site before heading off again on its eastward trek towards Glenelg. Along the way, it's been taking multiple high-definition images of the 5-kilometre-high Mount Sharp in order to build up a three-dimensional image of the terrain to help it decide which path to follow towards the mountain. Mount Sharp was selected as the destination for the rover because of its sedimentary layers, which scientists believe will allow Curiosity to read the Martian geology like a textbook. NASA's new mission to study extreme space weather events and how they affect the Van Allen radiation belts has finally blasted into space. The initial countdown for the $686 million mission was scrubbed during launch polling to resume the countdown after a scheduled hold at T-minus 4 minutes. The problem turned out to be a faulty tracking beacon on the east launch range, resulting in a 24-hour postponement. However, an attempt to launch the following day was again scrubbed because of stormy weather whipped up by Hurricane Isaac. The next launch window was a week later, and it was a case of third time lucky as the United Launch Alliance Lockheed Martin Boeing Atlas V rocket finally successfully blasted off Pad 41 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida.
Status check.
Go Atlas.
Go Centaur.
Lift off the Atlas V rocket and twin spacecraft on a mission to unlock the mysteries of Earth's Van Allen belt.
Booster used on close of control. Roll program is complete. Excellent. Booster engines continuing to operate nominally. Max Q. Vehicle continues to fly well. Dynamic rates look good. And boosters throttled back. Engine response looks good. Current altitude is 11.2 nautical miles, downrange distance 8.1 miles, velocity is 2,340 miles per hour.
On board the 58-metre-tall rocket were the twin radiation-belt storm probes, bound for their highly elliptical orbit ranging from 500 to over 40,000 kilometres in altitude above the ground. The solar-powered probes, heavily shielded to operate in the radiation belts, are flying in slightly different orbits that are inclined 10 degrees to the planet's equator, allowing them to periodically overlap each other. At times, they'll be within 160 kilometres of each other. At other times, that'll stretch out to 38,625 kilometres. Scientists hope the data the probes will uncover will help improve space weather forecasts, warning of events that can disable satellites, affect radio communications, overload power grids, and disrupt GPS services. They'll help scientists better understand how space weather interacts with the Van Allen radiation belts, two donut-shaped regions that encircle the Earth. They're named after the late University of Iowa physicist Professor James A. Van Allen, who discovered them in 1958 using Explorer 1, America's first satellite. The belts are held in place by the Earth's magnetic field, which traps electrically charged particles from the sun and deep space. But just how the belts form and why they sometimes balloon out is still a long-standing mystery. The inner belt extends from about 6,500 to 20,000 kilometres above the ground. The larger outer belt stretches from an altitude of around 13,000 kilometres to about 60,000 kilometres and is where most communication satellites orbit. The probes will be the first to study the belts in more than 20 years. Their two-year mission will study the high-energy particles, magnetic and electric fields and waves that occur inside the belts and how these react to changes caused by the sun as it moves towards next year's climax of its 11-year solar cycle. The number and strength of space weather storms, which blast billions of tons of ionized particles, mostly atomic nuclei and stripped electrons, from the sun, increases dramatically during this time. When these particles reach Earth, scientists believe that many become trapped in the magnetosphere, helping to form and maintain the Van Allen belts. The number of protons and electrons populating the belts can increase dramatically, and their speeds can approach the speed of light. Now, at such relativistic speeds, even minuscule particles like electrons can inflict serious damage to anything they hit. Dr. Phil Wilkinson is the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Meteorology's Ionospheric Prediction Service.
Well, they've got two probes here, and they'll be orbiting in very similar but not the same place. At the moment, if you have only one observation, you've got to assume that you can propagate the knowledge you've gained from that observation throughout the entire belt. And it leaves us great uncertainty as you move away from the location where you've made the observation. So now they have two observations, and they'll be able to test the assumptions they've made. And those assumptions are embedded deep in our understanding of what the radiation belts are. So in some cases, they'll find that their two probes agree with one another, and in other cases they're going to find differences. We can be sure that the subtle differences are the ones that really tell us something new about the radiation belts. If you go back to the late 50s when they discovered them, the words they said in the newspaper were, "We can't go into space, it's full of radiation." And that still exists as a problem, that the radiation belts got their name because of the fact that on a Geiger counter they went off the count upper level because of the amount of high energy particles there. And anything that goes into space is going to pass through these belts, and anything that's sitting out in space is quite possibly orbiting within, particularly the further out the satellites are, they're orbiting within this radiation environment, which is hazardous for both people and things.
So how do you get through there? How did the astronauts get to the moon?
They didn't stay there very long.
They just went through really quickly.
Really, you know, the Earth's magnetic field takes off from one pole, bends round and comes back into the other pole. So you come out from the North Pole, if you like, goes into the South Pole. The gradient of the field can act as a trapping bottle for charged particles. We know that some of these are ionospheric particles and they've energized up. Some of these have come in from the magnetic tail of the magnetosphere, and others come from cosmic rays. So there's a whole range of ways in which they get into this position. And so in a sense, you've got a bottle there, and it's the source of the particles that's the really interesting part.
One of the things that keeps the bottle full are the charged charged particles coming from the Sun.
Those charged particles are coming in, well, particularly when we get events like coronal mass ejection, but any variations in that solar wind coming and enveloping the Earth will percolate down into that region of the radiation belts. I think people felt the radiation belts were a little separate from space weather if you go back 60s and 70s, which is probably the reason why this is the first probe in a couple of decades, that there was a feeling that they understood much of what was going on. It's now become very clear that we don't, or maybe we do, but we don't fully understand it. It's no longer that they're trapped there, but we want to know more about how they get there, and we want to know more about the circumstances of how they change. And those changes that occur happen because of the solar wind and because of coronal mass ejection is stuck in the solar wind.
That's Dr. Phil Wilkinson, the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Meteorology's Ionospheric Prediction Service. NASA's Dawn spacecraft, which has been exploring the main asteroid belt, has now departed Vesta and is on her way to study the dwarf planet Ceres. Telemetry from the spacecraft via NASA's Deep Space Communications Network confirmed thrust engaged and that the spacecraft has departed Vesta orbit and commenced a 2.5-year journey to Ceres. Dawn began her 5 billion kilometre odyssey to explore the two most massive objects in the main asteroid belt way back on September 27, 2007. Dawn achieved Vesta orbit insertion in July 2011 and will reach Ceres in early 2015. Dawn's targets represent two icons of the asteroid belt, bodies that have been witness to much of our solar system's history. To make its escape from Vesta, Dawn is spiralling away every bit as gently as it arrived, using a special hyper-efficient system called ion propulsion. Ion propulsion uses electricity to ionise xenon gas and generate thrust. While the 12-inch ion thruster provides far less power than conventional engines, it can maintain that thrust for months at a time. During its orbit around Vesta, Dawn provided close-up views of the asteroid's surface, revealing its features in unprecedented detail. Among Dawn's many discoveries about Vesta was the fact that the asteroid had completely differentiated. Now that means it solidified in a layered structure from a molten state with an iron core surrounded by a rocky mantle, then a thin crust on top. That means Vesta formed more like a planet rather than simply a huge chunk of rock that was knocked off something else in a gigantic collision. But the spacecraft also revealed scarring from titanic collisions which Vesta suffered in its southern hemisphere, surviving not one but two colossal impacts in at least the last 2 billion years. Without Dawn, scientists wouldn't have known about the dramatic troughs sculpted around Vesta, which are actually ripples from the two south polar impacts. By studying Vesta, Dawn has allowed astronomers to fill in many of the gaps about their knowledge of the early history of our solar system. And undoubtedly, when it gets to Ceres, more revelations will follow. We'll keep you informed. And time now once again to turn our eyes to the skies. Jeff White is Senior Astronomy Educator with the Powerhouse Museum Sydney Observatory. And he joins us now for Skywatch as we look at the night skies of September.
What we're going to do for our tour of September is start by looking about 60 degrees up from the western horizon. Well, west is fairly easy because at this time of the year, we have the equinox, so the sun is setting, if you like, fairly close to due west for most of the month. Come to the third of the four royal stars. This is an intriguing idea, and it dates back many, many thousands of years to that great region of the world, the cradle of civilization, as it's been referred to, Mesopotamia, between the rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates. One of the most enduring uses of the stars has been as some form of calendar to mark the passing of the year. And thousands of years ago, and we're talking 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, people in the Euphrates region used four bright stars close to the ecliptic, and I'll explain about the ecliptic as we go, to measure the main points, and they are the equinoxes and the solstice. The star we're looking for here, 60 degrees above the western horizon, was the third of the four royal stars. It's a red supergiant. It's the 15th brightest star in the night sky and the brightest star in the constellation of Scorpius. Its name, Antares. Antares is quite a spectacular star. It's about 800 times the diameter of the Sun. Yes, it's enormously big. It's about 600 light years away. So this star, Antares, it means rival to Mars. You see, from here, occasionally, when the planet Mars slides past as we look at it, they look remarkably similar. So its name has come from Anti-Aries, or rival to the planet Mars, or Aries as it was in Greek. This star not only marks the position of the autumnal equinox thousands of years ago, but I've got to stress no longer. You see, the Earth does a 26,000-year wobble on its axis, so that point is no longer near this star. But anyway, so this star is bright, it's easy to see, it's golden orange reddish, which means it's coming towards the end of its life. Now that we've seen Scorpius, and it is, of course, a scorpion, we're actually going to go back down towards the west just a little bit. The reason we've done this, instead of starting here and then going back up, is because the next few stars we're going to look at are actually rather faint. But also, they used to be part of the constellation of Scorpius. Most of the constellations that people are familiar with are the zodiacs, which simply means the circle of the animals. And all bar one of them were created thousands of years ago in the area of Mesopotamia. But a little over 2,000 years ago, the Romans, around the time of Julius Caesar, started talking about a group of stars that used to belong to Scorpius and were part of the claws, and broke them off to form a set of scales. So this is the only zodiac constellation that's not a living creature. It's the only zodiac that is not from Mesopotamia. So why are we looking at it? Well, it's a zodiac constellation, which means, of course, that the sun, the moon, and the planets throughout the year will drift through this part of the sky. What I love about it is the names that we see. What's happened in astronomy is the stories have not only been passed down from generation to generation, but from culture to culture. What we have is a rich mix of cultural astronomy, and many of the names that we use can be traced back to Arabic origins, again from the area of Mesopotamia. So the three stars that I want you to try and find in Libra are Zubin el-Gnubi, Zubin el-Shamali, and Zubin el-Akrab. Now, I'm pretty sure I haven't pronounced those correctly, but that's all right, because that's what's been going on for years and years and years, and the pronunciations have changed. These are very old Arabic words, which mean these stars of Libra used to belong to Scorpio. Zubin is an old Arabic word which means scorpion. So Zubin el-Gnubi is simply the southern claw of the scorpion. Zubin el-Shamali is the northern claw of the scorpion, and Zubin el-Akrab simply means scorpion's claw. So that's the constellation of Libra the Scales.
That's the Powerhouse Museum's senior astronomy educator, Jeff White. For more details, go to sydneyobservatory.com.au. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff all as one word in lowercase and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.